Hey guys, we're going to kick things off this week like we do every week with all the big news of the week. Then I got a very special guest coming in, and we'll wrap things up with all of your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, we're back. Welcome in. It's the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer. Week 4 is in the books. We're going to get to a great guest we've got this week, a good friend of mine. We're going to get to all your mail in the mailbag, but we're going to kick things off like we always do with the big news topics of the week. And coming out of the weekend, I don't think there's a question what number one is. It was the hit that Vontaze Burfict laid on Colts tight end Jack Doyle. I wish it wasn't that way, that this is the first thing we've got to talk about. But that's where we're at right now. And this is a guy who's got a ton of history, of course. This is a guy who is reviled by a lot of other players. And this is a guy who now, as of Monday, is suspended for the rest of the NFL season. And to me, this was a no-brainer. The league doing what it needed to do. And it's not because of this singular incident, which the hit was bad, man. It was bad. It's the string of repeated behavior. And we can go right back over it. In January 2016, he was suspended for the first time for a helmet-to-helmet hit. That was the shot that everybody remembers on Antonio Brown. In August of 2017, was assessed a 5-game suspension for a hit in a preseason game against Chiefs fullback Anthony Sherman. That was reduced down to 3 games. November 2017, he was ejected from a game against the Titans after making contact with an official. In April 2018, he was suspended. Now, this is different. He was suspended for violating the PED policy. And then, of course, on Sunday, you have the hit, helmet-to-helmet, on Jack Doyle. And so, to me, this is something that I don't think the league had to think very long and hard about. And I think that there's a recognition, even on the other end, that there's not going to be a great reduction in the scope of the penalty here. Otherwise, they would have been looking to expedite this thing and push it through the process. He did come back from London, but he's not going to file his appeal till next week. That's, I mean, basically yielding a game check, right? So if you're willing to yield a game check just like that, you got a pretty good idea that if there's any chance of any victory happening in the appeal process here, it's going to be about mitigating the penalty, not eliminating it. Okay, number two, Steelers won on Monday night. I actually thought it was fairly impressive, and here's why. The defense finally looks like it can take over games again. And look, I know the Bengals have their offensive line issues. No Jonah Williams, no Cordy Glenn. I know there's no A.J. Green there, and that's obviously an issue. But that looked like a fast, talented group that's capable of imposing its physical will on other teams. And it's been a while since the Steelers have been there on defense. In fact, there was a period, if you want to go back and look at the history of it, the Steelers spent 20 years, right? Now, this is going back to Bill Cowher's second year in Pittsburgh. For 20 years, every year, they were 12th or higher in total defense. And in 13 of those 20 years, they were top five. And we can go through all the names that were there in those years. Greg Lloyd, Kevin Green, more recently guys like Troy Polamalu, Ike Taylor, James Harrison. Great, great defenses, right? Like, that's what's been their calling card forever. Well, more recently, 13th in 2013, 18th in 2014, 21st in 2015. A little bit of an uptick after that, and then they were 19th last year. They just have not been able to fully recover from losing the guys that they won their last set of Super Bowls with. Again, the Troy Polamalus, the Ryan Clarks, the Ike Taylors, the James Harrisons, the James Ferriers, the Aaron Smiths, like that whole group, they never really fully recovered. And what I think was so encouraging about last night was the ability of the individual physical ability of some of the guys that was on display. TJ Watt, we know about Tua and Hayward on the inside on that defensive front. What Devin Bush looks like he's going to be able to do. Minkah Fitzpatrick starting to get his feet wet in the defense. I thought it was really encouraging because it showed that the Steelers may be able to win a different way. They've been winning with their passing game with Ben Roethlisberger, with Antonio Brown, with Juju Smith-Schuster. Like, they've been winning that way the last few years. this shows an ability to win a different way. I also like the creativity on offense. So I do think there were some encouraging things there for a Steelers team that's now, despite an 0-3 start, only a game out of first place. News topic number three, the Browns bounced back in a very big way. And I thought this was a huge spot for the Browns to go into Baltimore and play a very good Ravens team, a very well-rounded Ravens team that felt like it had something to prove to Cleveland after all the hype that Cleveland got over the course of the offseason. To go in there and punch them in the mouth the way that they did, I thought it was really impressive. And I'll tell you this. This is what I said during the week, okay? John Dorsey has a way about building teams. In Kansas City, look at the way he built those teams. You see the risks he took. He took guys like Tyreek Hill, Marcus Peters, Kareem Hunt. John Dorsey clearly has no problem rolling the dice. Thing is, in Kansas City, he was handing all of those guys to a guy in Andy Reid who had, at the time, more than a decade and now has 2 decades of NFL head coaching experience, who had gone through things like that in Philadelphia and bringing in guys who were risk guys at the time, guys like Terrell Owens and Mike Vick. So this is different because you've got a first-year head coach. And I think Freddie Kitchens would tell you this. Like, we don't know. He didn't know how this would all play out when the crap hit the fan. To me, like, that was always going to be the test. What happens when things get shaken up a little bit? I think it was a great sign for that program that Freddie Kitchens was able to keep that team together in what had to be a very difficult week. All the stuff that they were hearing, their one win was against a Jets team that can't get out of its own way right now. And they had 2 really ugly losses. And you had the issues with discipline. You had the issues in the offensive line. And to be able to come back and scheme it up the way they schemed it up, get a little more creative on offense, play as disciplined as they did against Lamar Jackson on defense, just have the whole thing tied together, I think was really, really impressive. And I thought it was really interesting talking to Freddie after the game how he said on Saturday night, I told them to lean back on what happened and what we did in training camp. I told them this is why we were in pads in training camp. And so you see where, you know, I think Freddie sort of got in front of some of this stuff in July and August because he knew, like every team does, that the Browns would deal with something happening, something going wrong. And now I'm not saying they're out of the woods, but to go through the month they went through, come out of it 2-2, and be riding, you know, some good feelings out of a win like that, I think is really, really good. Number four, so the Dak Prescott contract situation lingers out there. He didn't play as well this week against the Saints as he had the first 3 weeks of the season. I still think that the Cowboys have to take care of him. And I think there's like a natural point in the Cowboys' schedule when they can do this. Now, I was covering the Cowboys when they did their deal with Tony Romo, Tony Romo's first big contract, and that was in 2007, and they did it during the bye week. Well, the Cowboys' bye week this year falls right at the end of October, and so it would make sense if that was when the Dak Prescott contract got done. The bigger question here is whether or not Dak should do it. I think the Cowboys are willing to pay him, you know, in the neighborhood of like what Goff got, what Carson Wentz got. But the closer you get to the end of the year, the harder this is going to be to do. Because every game that Dak Prescott goes out there, puts his body on the line, is one game closer to the team not taking on any, the team not buying back any of the injury risk. That's the way these things work. If you do a contract 2 years early, like the Rams did with Jared Goff, like the Eagles did with Carson Wentz, the team's basically taking 2 years of injury risk off the player, so they expect to give back. If you're not taking that injury risk off the player, then the player loses motivation to do do any sort of discount deal with you. And if I'm Dak Prescott, I look at Kirk Cousins, and that may be the model for what I want to do. I may look at what Kirk Cousins did, and I may say to myself, you know what? Franchise me in 2020. Franchise me in 2021. And then in 2022, I can hit the open market, or you're going to have to pay me an exorbitant number. And so I think unless the Cowboys put something really great in front of Dak Prescott, it may make sense for him to force them to put the franchise tag on him. Okay, and real quick, just to wrap up the news items for the week, number 5 this week, the Antonio Brown grievance. He's filing 9 of them. I've seen the contract language. I think that my feeling on this is that 8 of the 9, he doesn't have much of a case on, because both the Raiders and Patriots put pretty heavy protection in the deals as relates to the guaranteed money. There's one piece of money that I think he's going to get back, and that's that $9 million signing bonus. And here's the reason why, and I don't want to bore everybody with legalese, and we'll get to my guest here in a second. But the reason why I think AB gets that $9 million signing bonus, there's a very narrow path for a player or for a team to recover signing bonus money. And one of the ways to do it, I think the only case the Patriots would have here is something called non-disclosure. That basically means there was something in your past that could affect your playing status that you did not tell the team about. Okay? Let's just say the Patriots were being forthright when it got out there that they didn't know. I don't know if I fully believe that with Belichick. I do believe the Crafts didn't know, but let's just say that the Patriots didn't know. If they didn't know on Tuesday of that week, which was the day after he officially signed, then why did they put him on the game field the following Sunday if they had such a problem with it? And that's why I think Antonio Brown winds up with $9 million. It's pretty logical, right? Okay, you did something. There's something here that we didn't know about that could affect your ability to go to work for our team. And we're not happy about it. We're not happy about the way it reflects on our franchise. We're not happy about the fan reaction to it. We're not happy about that. But yet, you put him out there on CBS in your colors, with your logos, with your marks on it. It's just, I think that makes it very, very difficult to make the case that the Patriots shouldn't have to pay out the $9 million that they pledged to Antonio Brown as a signing bonus. Again, that money was deferred, but that money, you know, as far as the union is concerned, is considered money earned. All right, with no more delay, we're going to bring in our guest right after this. All right, now we're going to bring in a good buddy of mine, former Ohio State linebacker, former first-round pick of the Dallas Cowboys. You can now see him on Get Up on ESPN and on 97.1, The Fan in Columbus. Bobby Carpenter, what's going on?
Albert, thanks for having me on, sir.
You got it. All right, so one of the reasons I wanted to bring you in, and we're going to get into the football stuff here in a second, but one of the reasons I wanted to bring you in is because what's in the news this week with Vontaze Burfict and the suspension. And I think all of us, like, we watched the game played at that level, and it's just kind of like you see a hit like that, and it kind of makes, you know, the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I just wonder, as a former player, knowing what it's like out there between those lines, when you first saw the hit, the Vontaze Burfict on Jack Doyle on Sunday, what was the first thing that ran through your head?
You know, when I first saw that, I just rolled my eyes at it, because here's the thing. If that would have been another player, it wouldn't have been as big a deal with me, just because they wouldn't have been the history. And history is important with this, because I think as you watch the games on Sunday, you could see 10 times where quarterbacks are sliding now, and guys are diving over the top of them, doing everything they can to avoid them. And occasionally you see like an arm brush a helmet, and the ref looks to throw a flag, and I'm thinking, come on, man. Like, we're protecting these guys. I understand they're very valuable on offense. But at some point in time, like, they have a helmet and shoulder pads on, and they're protected as well with pads. So let's not be crazy here. So, you know, I see that, and I'm like, that's getting a little ridiculous. The problem is when you have a pattern of behavior where you've consciously gone out and done things like this over and over again, and the league has warned you, and they've told you, and this isn't some incidental thing where it's a bang-bang play and you turn and the guy is kind of lowering as you're attacking him and it's really close. Because I always make the argument, like, what do you want the guy to do? And that happens. And it happens to guys maybe once a year, twice a year. But you get flagged on it sometimes. Sometimes you don't. But with Vontaze Burfict, this is a situation where he's finding dudes and lining them up. And there was a time in the game where that was okay. And it was appreciated. Heck, it was endorsed. People loved it. But I think we've just gotten to the point now where people don't want to see it anymore. And whether or not as a defensive player I like it, you have to play within the rules that they've set. And so you may can fight with them all you want, but this is eventually going to probably cost him his career.
I know it's hard to crawl into someone else's head, but what do you think he's thinking? or do you like?
I'm just gonna go knock this dude out. Like yeah. that's the only thing that I could think that is going through his mind because he doesn't seem to care. I mean, you saw it. You know, he was headhunting AB a couple years ago. Like it's just the guy. He just can't care. And you know what? That's the way he wants to play the game. And if he played in 1980, man, he would be glorified and people would be loving it. The problem is that we're in a different era today. And if you want to play defense, you have to play by the NFL's rules.
So, like, how far does the code go for players then? And you played that position, so you probably have pretty good insight to this. Like, I know, like, I've heard tons of players say, like, there's a certain level where you do start, where guys do take care of each other. You know, how far does that code go?
I would say a lot of it depends on timing, situation, the team you're playing against, bitter rivals, playoffs. I mean, all bets are always off. But I never went out there, and 90% of the guys, like 95, maybe even more, never went out there with the intention of trying to hurt someone. You may try to knock a dude out of the game, but you want to do it like – and back in the day, you used to be able to hit guys in the head across the middle. And so you're thinking, like, I'll give him a concussion because that really – you know, you really didn't understand the broader impact, but as long as you were like hitting a guy in the knees, it was all good. Like, don't be going low on me. That was always the big thing. And now it's, you know, you're hitting a guy in the head. It's people we realize we've come a little bit further, you know, in society and with technology to understand the significance of that. And so, like, hey, man, you want to crack a dude's ribs? You go crack a guy's ribs. Like, don't give me the defenseless receiver crap. He has shoulder pads on, and the quarterback shouldn't have thrown it in there.
Do you remember, like, have there been hits that you felt bad about?
I don't know if I've ever felt bad about, you know, you get a handful of really good ones a yeah. season you feel good about, but I never, there was not, unless it was one, Bert, that was like unintentionally below the waist.
Yeah.
In the crotch, that's the only one where like, my bad, bro. Like that was not intentional. That's the only one where I'd ever look at a guy and tell them, hey. You know, that, just so they know that that's not where your head's at, and that's not the type of player you are.
So for you, like you were right, I think like because you came in the league in 06, right? Like, so you yes. were probably like middle to end of your career when the rules changes started to come in, and all that's obviously related to the lawsuits and everything else that were going on. How much did you have to adjust the way you played when those things started to come into football?
A lot, because I remember when I was in college, you know, you would go and you try to hit quarterbacks in the head to knock them out of the game. Like that was something like a conscious effort. Like you're going high, face mask to face mask, and let's put them down and like land on them with all your weight, do everything you could. Like, and you didn't want to end a guy's career, but like, hey, I can knock the wind out of them. Shake him up a little bit because even if you don't give him, you're not trying to give him a concussion. Just nobody likes to get hit like that, and so
you're letting him know you're there, though.
What
you're like, sort of letting him know that you're,
yeah,
that you're there,
100%.
Right?
It's
yeah.
just an awareness thing. Like this guy's gonna maybe sail a pass, throw it out of bounds. Like it's an awareness thing for them. And then when I never forget when maybe my third or fourth year, they put the rule like you couldn't hit the quarterback in the helmet. I'm like, all right, and it was started out with your helmet, and then it's like arm, and like. Listen, you know, you're hitting them with your arm in their helmet. Like, your arm's probably going to hurt worse than their head is. Like, it's a helmet. It's designed to protect them. And that was kind of the first time we started seeing some of those glancing blows and they're throwing flags. I'm like, that was completely unintentional. Guys getting blocked, quarterbacks moving. Like, what do you expect them to do? And that's probably about 10 years ago now. And you've seen the full evolution where, I mean, guys are doing – like, they just grab them and wrap them up now. Like, there's not even an attempt to try to slam a guy, take him to the ground. Like, if you get him in the grasp, we're good. And you see the refs, usually they blow a quick whistle because of it. And so it hurts some guys that could maybe run and break a tackle. But I guarantee the older guys are probably liking it all the same.
See, I think, to me, because I would think – so, I mean, I guess this will change over time, right, if you're teaching the game differently at the lower levels. But – I would think that like when the game's moving that fast and you're I guess you're like your earning power literally is tied to how fast you're moving, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I would think that it would be pretty hard at that level of football to adjust, right? Oh. Because so much of it's based on instinct and what you've kind of taught your body to do, right? Like is that I mean I would assume that that'd be really really tough to do.
Well, it's tough because when we frame by frame this thing, yeah. Bert, it looks so easy on television.
Yep.
Those things happen in a split second, and you're reacting, and you're just trying to get a guy to the ground. and you're trying to do it in a way that you're not hurting yourself as well. Because now you're seeing guys like they're moving their heads, like guys are start hurting their necks, and defensive players might injure themselves trying to avoid a collision that could cause a penalty, could cause them to get a fine or whatever it is. Because when we sit there and you're sitting there in the comfort, I'm guilty of it even now at home, like, oh, yeah, that's obvious. And then you see it in real speed, like, not a chance.
Yeah.
Not a chance. Like, yeah. I've been in that situation. The guy's running 20 miles an hour at you. You're running 16 miles an hour at him. And you're trying to make a decision literally in, like, a hundredth of a second of where to hit him and where do you think he's going to go. And it's so incredibly difficult.
So where do you land on, like, guys getting fined for this? Like, the league literally taking, like, 10 grand out of a guy's pocket for a play like that.
Well, to me, I think there needs to be some intent.
Like, yeah.
If you see somebody that they're habitually doing it, sure. You see a time where a guy lines a guy up, okay. But then you also see times where receivers are catching slants, falling to the ground. You know, a linebacker or safety is coming across, and their initial target angle is at the guy's hip or at his waist. And then all of a sudden, they're hitting him in the shoulder, glancing blow on the helmet. And I'm thinking, well, what did you want him to do? How could he have anticipated that the ball was going to be thrown low and that he was going to have to make a play like that? It doesn't work.
So do you feel like I noticed, like, what you're saying, like, everything's sort of, like, from the defensive player's eyes. You guys did feel like the league was sort of, I mean, like, that's not, like, the way it's sort of set up is sort of unfair, too,
well,
right?
It's an offensive league, but I will tell you this, Albert. I was talking with Ryan Clark as we were watching games in the War Room on Sunday. The amount of offensive pass interferences that are called now is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, you used to see the amount that's called on one Sunday. That was like the amount called in an entire season.
Yep.
And so as a defensive player, I might be able to get behind that a little bit more. Like, okay, you're going to be a little more critical of me, of where I hit guys, but you're also now finally going to call something that has been going on for decades that just was pushed under the rug. So if there's a little give and take, I think you're going to see defensive players, especially guys in the back end, the linebackers, safeties, and corners, a little bit more conscientious about it because you feel like it's not just a game that's completely dominated by the offense.
Okay, last thing for me on this, we'll get into mid-season or quarter-season awards here. Is there like a list of players? Maybe it's not an actual list, but, you know, you mentioned Burfict's got the history. Is there like a list of, like, bad dudes? You know what I mean? Or guys who, like, you know what I mean? Like, is there, like, when you're in it, you know, and when you're one of the guys that's in the league, is there a list of dudes where you sort of have your radar up for something dirty to happen? And I'd assume Burfict would be at the top of the list now, but is that sort of like something that's unspoken that all of you guys knew?
I would say this, like, there's very few guys that I would deem as, like, straight dirty.
Yeah.
Brandon Merriweather, when he was with the Patriots, he was out headhunting all the time, and, like, that was getting a bit ridiculous. But most of the time I look at guys, and, like, and I would say it's guys you love on your team and hate to play against, and because they're always just pushing the boundary of the rules. Like, Clinton Portis, and people look at him as a running back. Like, if you go back and watch him pass blocking, he used to light dudes up, face, like, helmet into face mask. He'd hide behind one of the guards or a tackle and pop out and just TKO guys all the time. And I mean, it wasn't a cheap shot, but you knew that it was coming. You knew when he was in the game, you had to always be aware of it. Like, Richie Incognito is another guy. Like, people say that, you know, outside everything that happened in Miami, like, Richie's a really good player. He is nasty and tough, and he's a guy you hate to play against. When you talk to dudes on this team, they're like, dude, we're glad he's with us. Like, he's a great run blocker. He's tough. He sets the tone. He's a physical guy. Like, he pushes it right to the limit. Maybe he steps over occasionally. Yeah. But, I mean, you have guys like that, but very, very rarely outside of, like, you know, Mayweather or Verberfect, like, guys where you looked at and you're like, that dude's just dirty and he's trying to knock dudes out all the time.
Yeah, like, the ultimate example, I remember this, like, when I was covering New England, was Rodney Harrison. Like,
they
loved him in that locker room, but, like, other teams always had their radar up for him.
Mm-hmm.
No question. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to go through quarter season awards. I've got mine. I want to give those to you guys. I want to give Bobby a chance to chime in on these too. So, Bobby, we'll go blow by blow. I've got six of them. I think six awards that I'm going to give out here. And, like, just so everybody knows, the one thing here, like, this is based on what's happened, not, like, necessarily what I think is going to happen over the next 13 weeks, but what's happened through a quarter of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll start with the MVP. My MVP is the same MVP we had last year. That's Patrick Mahomes. And Bobby, here's the reason why I would make him MVP right now. They lost Tyreek Hill. He's able to make it work. They're integrating a rookie in Mecole Hardman. They've got, on the other side, like a new scheme going in defensively, a bunch of new pieces, Tyrann Mathieu, Frank Clark. And to be able to like go through the level of transition that they've gone through, and even they lose their center, Mitch Morse, which kind of flew under the radar, but that did happen. To be able to kind of like ride that out, I think that's the mark of a great quarterback, right? When there's a lot of things going kind of sideways around you, or there's transition around you, and you're able to kind of pull the team through. So Mahomes would be my MVP through 4 weeks.
Yeah, I think you'd be foolish to kind of go with anyone else at this point. And to me, like, the Detroit game kind of summed it up. It was a game that he didn't throw a touchdown pass, but he was incredible doing the things he needed to do to get his team to win. Like, ultimately, that's what you're tasked with. There's gonna be games you throw 5 touchdown passes, there'll be games you throw 1. Can you win in both situations as a quarterback? And Mahomes has been able to do that. And you'll watch it, he'll run the ball. Like, I mean, I think he was their second leading rusher in the game as well. So
I mean, there was a third and 8 in there, right, where he pulled it down and went
for
15 yards. Yeah,
it was the second longest run of the game, and that's like, he just does whatever it takes. And he's not a me guy, which helps too. So I've enjoyed Patrick Mahomes immensely.
No question. Okay, so Offensive Player of the Year is kind of a weird award because it's like always could be
second runner up.
Yeah. So what I usually try to do with this one is I usually try to make it a position other than the quarterback and the best just offensive player in the league. And I'll tell you what, Bobby, I sort of wanted to give this to Alvin Kamara just because I think that he's meant a lot to the Saints in making it work, you know, after Breeze went down and everything else. But then I started to look at the numbers, and my God, Christian McCaffrey. I mean, like 629 yards from scrimmage already. They are leaning on him a bunch, and I think he's answered the bell for them. You know, it's another one of these cases where there's a lot sort of going on around him with the Cam Newton injury. And, you know, I would definitely put Alvin Kamara in that group. Dalvin Cook's another one who, yes, I think had to carry his offense. Right now, just based on the numbers and the amount his team's leaning on him, I'd go with Christian McCaffrey.
Yeah, Dalvin Cook, until this Sunday, I probably would have given it to, but he got stymied a little bit this weekend against a really good defense. He's been absolutely phenomenal for the Vikings, and he's carried that team. They just want to pound it all the time. But Christian McCaffrey, especially without Cam Newton, the offense starts and stops with him. And I'm worried that he might only play like 6 or 7 years, yeah, because of his usage rate.
Yep.
But he has been a special dude to watch.
Okay, I'm going to go a little off the board on Defensive Player of the Year. And I'm interested to hear, you know, what you have to say on this. Now, there are good candidates out there. Shaquille Barrett, like, has come out of nowhere.
It has to be him. I'm glad you said that.
It's come out of nowhere for 9 sacks.
Yes.
And he would be my runner-up. Miles Garrett's been great. Miles Garrett's been great with 6 sacks. I'm going to give you one that's really off the board here. Jamie Collins from New England, who was overweight in Cleveland. there's no better way to put it. I mean, I know the Patriots people, when they watched him on tape, they thought he was playing heavy there. He's got 3 picks. He's got 3.5 sacks. He's been all over the place. And here's the key to me. I almost think Defensive Player of the Year sometimes becomes a team award, Bobby, in that if you're not playing on a top 5 defense, you probably, and generally, like, if you're on a transcendent defense, it's hard not to give it to a guy on that kind of group. The Patriots have allowed 1 offensive touchdown through 4 weeks. They are playing at another level altogether. And I think Jamie Collins coming back there has been amazing. And now I don't think it's going to hold up, but I would give Jamie Collins the nod just because the amount of different things he's done for New England. And here's the other thing. And you played for Belichick. I can't remember the last time he just flat out called someone a special player in the media. And he did that a couple of weeks ago with Collins.
Yeah, he did that with Lawrence Taylor. That's like the only other guy that I can remember him giving that much praise to. Their defense has been tremendous, and he's been a big part of that. I look at what Shaq Barrett's done in Tampa, and, you know, Todd Bowles going down there, and, you know, Bruce Arians. Like, they've transformed that team from what they were, and he's been borderline unblockable. And, you know, like you said, it's just a quarter pole mark, but at 9 sacks,
yeah,
like, I would be amazed if this guy doesn't get to 20 this season, if he has 9 through, you know, 4 or 5 weeks.
You know, the crazy thing about it is, too, so he's like the third guy on Denver last year, right? Mm-hmm. And they had 0 sacks through 3 weeks, and then Bradley Chubb tears his ACL in week 4. And it's just, it's amazing the way that works out. And I mean, good job by Tampa too, to like a lot of cases. Like, I think these are the wins in free agency, right? When there's a guy who's a backup who like just isn't getting the opportunity, you know, and to be able to find a guy like that, like, I think really reflects well on the Bucks.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. My offensive rookie of the year. And again, this is the quarter poll, so it's just based on what we've seen. Gardner Minshew in Jacksonville. Do I think this is going to hold up? Maybe not. He's completing almost 70% of his passes, 7 touchdown passes, 1 pick. Some of the plays he made in Denver, the third down where I think he threw it opposite hash to the sideline to convert a third down towards the end of the game. It doesn't look like anything affects him, Bobby. I mean, it's just like
because of that mustache, man.
Yeah, the mustache and it's unbelievable. So I think, you know, Daniel Jones has looked good in spots, threw a couple of picks last week. Maybe Minshew is sort of benefiting from the fact that there wasn't, you know, a great number of skill position players that went high in last year's draft, but I think you got to give it to Minshew.
I would say that it's his right now, and maybe like you said, Daniel Jones is able to turn it on, you know, and continue to play well, and then he would probably get the nod, I think, probably due to draft position. Two other guys, though, to keep an eye on. Marquise Brown in Baltimore was lightning the first couple weeks. He was slowed down somewhat. And then Terry McLaurin, who did not play on Sunday, but through 3 games, it had 6 had 5 receptions in each game, and then also a touchdown pass, which I believe was a record.
Yep.
I think for a rookie in the NFL through his first 3 games. So both of those guys playing at a really high level, but it's an award that's most likely going to go to a quarterback or running back. And I think right now your man Minshew is leading the pack.
Yeah, I think like Kyler still. I mean, I you can't rule anything out because he's such a spectacular athlete. Like maybe they get it turned around, but to me, like he looks like he's got a ways to go. I'll just put it that way.
Well, so does their team. It's tough to.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to assess him because the offensive line is such a mess.
Yes.
Okay, so you mentioned a Buckeye and Terry McLaurin. I'm going to mention a Buckeye for Defensive Rookie of the Year. I think it's Nick Bosa. And as much as anything else, I'm basing this on the effect that he's had on the people around him. That defensive line has become a legitimate strength and maybe one of the best defensive lines in football now. And I think he benefits from the guys around him, but I also think they benefit from him. And so as of this point, he's only got 1 sack, but he's been a constant problem for offenses to deal with. And again, maybe I think Darnell Savage would be a good pick. Like has had off to a really good start in Green Bay playing for Mike Patton. But right now, you know, and Ed Oliver, I think is another guy who you got to kind of keep an eye on. His production sort of ramped up the last couple weeks, but I'm giving it to Nick Bosa right now.
Yeah. You know, I can see that, Nick, like you said, he doesn't have the big time numbers. I'll have to go back and look at his win rate, because that's what I look at a lot more for defensive linemen. Mm-hmm. Like, how fast are you winning and how often are you? Because sacks, they can be kind of a squirrely thing where other guys are getting there, you get flushed out of the pocket. But he has made that defensive line one of the best in the NFL. The guy who I really like, who I liked in the preseason a ton, is Josh Allen out of Jacksonville. And he's in a similar situation where Albert, he's around a lot of other great players, but he's starting to come on here, picked up a couple of sacks, he's forced a fumble. And, you know, I look for him to be kind of a DeMarcus Ware type player here, you know, for the next decade. But he's played pretty well through the first quarter poll of this season.
I'll tell you what, if he's DeMarcus Ware, the Jaguars are going to be pretty happy with what they got with that 7th overall pick. And like the last award, Coach of the Year, this is a little tough just because, you know, so much of it's based on body of work with coaches and everything else. I'm giving it to Kyle Shanahan.
Good.
In San Francisco. I just think, you know, to be able to, again, like, I think so much of it is just being able to adjust to what you've got. And they've had to, like, work through some things at quarterback. Jimmy's coming off the ACL. I think he'll be fine. But they've had to sort of find different ways to win. And I think Kyle's as good at that as anyone in the league. And so I think it's just sort of adjusting who they are. It's being able to ride out some of the things that they've dealt with. You know, some of the things that they've dealt with on offense, some of the injuries and everything else. Losing Joe Staley at left tackle was a big one. They got double-digit win over the over the Bucks, double-digit win over the Bengals, and then they come back and they beat the Steelers in week 3. So Kyle Shanahan coming off of his bye as my coach of the year through 4 weeks.
Yeah, you know, and he's the guy I went through and I just looked at the standings. I'm like, who's leading these divisions? And then you know, how much of that to me is coaching. And I instantly went to Kyle Shanahan. The other guy that I did look at was Matt LaFleur in Green Bay and what he's done. They're 3-1. You know, it's largely the same roster as a year ago. They're winning with defense. I think that offense, as we saw against the Eagles, is starting to click with Aaron Rodgers and what they're doing. I know they did struggle down there on the goal line, but I think with the job that he's done in Green Bay, now he does have a Hall of Fame quarterback, but they had one before, and Mike McCarthy isn't there for a reason. But I think Kyle Shanahan is the logical choice here through the first 4 or 5 weeks of the season.
LaFleur is going to be interesting too, because I know the defense didn't play as well against Philly on Thursday night, but if that defense keeps playing, like, can get back to the level they were the first 3 weeks, and you get the Rodgers you got on Thursday night, I mean, look out. That could wind up being a really good team when you get to November, December.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, Bobby, I always appreciate the time. You can catch him on 97.1 The Fan in Columbus and Get Up on ESPN. Always appreciate you coming out, bud.
Bert, I appreciate you having me on, sir.
All right, we're back, and I'm here to answer your questions like I am every week, because this is still relatively new. I'm going to take you guys through it again one more time. There are two ways you can get to us. We used to do it via Twitter. I think that this may be a little bit more effective, allow you guys to get some more detail in your questions, and also, if you really want to, get your voice on the podcast. Two ways you can get to us. You can email us at Breer Mailbag. That's my last name, B-R-E-E-R, mailbag@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a voicemail at 201-596-4346. That's BreerMailbag@gmail.com or call us at 201-596-4346. We'd love to hear your voice on the podcast. And without further ado, we're going to hear from you. Shelby, question number one.
It's from Andrew. With Jerry Jones being a major player in the NFL negotiations with the collective bargaining agreement, are the recent Cowboys extensions and their respective structures a sign that the salary cap is going to rise a lot in the next CBA?
I don't think it's necessarily related to Jerry having any information that any owner wouldn't have. There are rules that are governing teams' abilities to stash money in years post the current CBA, so that would be 2021 and beyond. What I would tell you is I do think the CBA, I do think that the cap is going to continue to go up, because the cap is just a calculation of total revenue, and it's a percentage of the revenue that's going to the players. And so the reason why the cap has gone up every year is because the TV contracts were built that way. And when they did the TV contracts after they did the 2011 CBA, the networks agreed to pay a little bit more each year. So when you look at the way that the cap has gone up, it's about $10 million a year over the last, I think, 5 years, 6 years, right? That relates back to when the TV contracts kicked in. So the salary cap was flat the first 3 years of this CBA. And then I believe it was in 2014 it started to rise because revenues were rising, because that's the way the TV contracts were built. I would expect it to be similar this time. I expect them to build the broadcast deal similarly. I do think the cap is going to go up, though. And the reason why, again, has nothing to do with inside information, is the different ways the league's going to have to make money now. So you're going to have the broadcast deals, which, again, I expect them to crush it in the broadcast deals. The streaming rights are way more valuable than they were. So how does that play into it? Do you have Amazon and Google and DAZN and all of those companies? Do you have them bidding against NBC? Are you doing separate deals? Like, there's just a lot of money to be made there. And that's without even getting to gambling. And gambling is going to be a big factor too. So I would expect that the salary cap 5 years from now, 10 years from now, is going to be much higher than it is right now. But again, not based on anything Jerry knows, just based on where the sport's going. Question number two, Shelby.
From Hank. Teddy Bridgewater is the highest paid backup quarterback in the league, but I'd say about 70% of Saints fans would like to see Taysom Hill start in place of him. Normally, I wouldn't bat an eye at this, as I know Bridgewater is a more established player at the position, but Sean Payton has gone out of his way to tell NFL Hall of Famers that he can be some version of Steve Young. Is it the Saints fans' fault for wanting to see what the coach sees and talks about constantly?
I think what the fans always want to see, right? I think what fans always want to see is where the ceiling is, right? They don't want something that's safe. They don't want something that's just going to sort of help you get by. They want to see where the ceiling is. And I think in this case, the reason you pay Teddy Bridgewater $7.5 million is basically an investment back into Drew Brees. Here's what I mean. If your quarterback goes down, if you got a quarterback like a Brees, like a Brady, like what Peyton Manning was, like what Aaron Rodgers is, you got a quarterback like that, your quarterback goes down, 99 times out of 100, I know there's the Nick Foles example out of there, 99 times out of 100, you're screwed. Your season's up a creek. Good night. So why would you pay a backup quarterback that much? Well, what happens if your quarterback suffers a four-week injury, a six-week injury, an eight-week injury? You want to have somebody who can go in there and who can keep the ship steady while your quarterback is on the mend. And so, to me, with Drew Brees at 40 years old, every one of these years that you have with him is so valuable because you don't know what's on the other side of that. And so what you're paying for Teddy Bridgewater to do right now is preserve a Drew Brees season to get you to 5-3 or 6-2 when he comes back. So then you're in position to compete. You still have that year with Drew Brees rather than the bottom falling out like it did for, say, like the Colts in 2011 when Peyton Manning got hurt. And so I know what you're saying. I understand, like, you want to see more of Taysom Hill. I think right now, this for the Saints, is about getting themselves to the beginning of November in position to compete. And if I'm a Saints fan right now, I'm not complaining about having swept the last two games. Because I'll tell you, I thought best case scenario, after losing Drew Brees, best case scenario, I thought they split Seattle and Dallas. So to be able to go 2-0 now, I think they're playing with house's money. And you look at the way the next 4 weeks set up, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's not impossible they get to 7-1. And I think they've got a really good shot to get to 6-2. Shelby, question number three.
Hey, Albert, loving the show. Hey, I'm a fan from Cincy. Just had a question about this year's Bengals squad. The offensive line's horrendous. The defense is not good, although they're playing hard. Do you think it might be time to move away from Andy Dalton and maybe see what Ryan Finley's got? You know, with all the changes going around in the league with the QBs, I just wonder if maybe that could be a move that Zach Taylor could do to spark something in the offense. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, next time, buddy, leave your name. I would like to thank you personally for leaving the voicemail. I do appreciate you taking the time to do that. Here's what I would tell you. I think you have to do what you can to figure out how Andy Dalton fits Zach Taylor and whether or not that's a viable option going forward. Okay? They're not going anywhere this year. I think the offensive line issue has made it that way. So this is sort of going to be a transitional year anyway, and it was to begin with the new coach, and that's the first time you've had a new coach since 2002 or 2003. So to me, so much of this is about where are we going from here? What's next for the Cincinnati Bengals? And I think a big piece of that has to be based on the fact that you've already invested 8-plus years in the development of Andy Dalton. It behooves you to see where Dalton's ceiling is with the Bengals and what he might be worth to you going forward. Remember, you still have him under contract for another year after this. And so, worst case, he could be a bridge for you. All right? So find out what you've got there. Then I think once we get to the last month of the season, that's when you want to find out what you've got in Ryan Finley. Just so you go into the 2020 offseason informed. You want to go into the 2020 offseason with as much information as you possibly can. Because if you stay this bad, you're going to have to make a decision on Tua Tagovailoa, on Justin Herbert, on Jordan Love, on Jake Fromm. You're going to have to make a decision on those guys. And so I think you want to have as full a picture of the landscape as you possibly can. Maybe you're not wild about any of those guys. Maybe you want to punt to 2021 when, you know, you've got Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields and all those guys coming out. You just want to give yourself as full a picture of the quarterbacking landscape as you possibly can. Because one of the reasons you brought in Zach Taylor in the first place was because of his expertise in the position. And so gather as much information as you can. Gather information on Andy Dalton over the next couple months so you can compare him to Tua, to Herbert, to love, even to Lawrence and Fields. And then get yourself a little look at Finley too, so you can go into the 2020 offseason armed with as much information as possible. Shelby, question number four.
It's from Andrew. Have teams begun calling the Broncos about trading for guys like Von Miller, Chris Harris, and Emmanuel Sanders? And are the Broncos open to trading them?
So I would say the one name I have heard that the Broncos have fielded calls on was Emmanuel Sanders. I think that there's a decent chance that Manny Sanders gets traded before the trade deadline, which is right around Halloween. Okay, so I think Emmanuel Sanders is one piece that I could absolutely see being moved. You mentioned Chris Harris. Chris Harris is another one. In a contract year, he could be moved. Von Miller to me is a different one because Von Miller to me is almost at this point like a quarterback for them, right? Like face of the franchise. For John Elway, like kind of like the reminder of the things that he did well, of the great years that he did have before things went south. But certainly I think that, you know, the future for the Broncos is going to be leaning on the last two draft classes, developing them over the next 3 months, maybe preparing yourself to take a quarterback in 2020. I just think so much of this is going to have to be being real with yourself about where you are. And that's been difficult for Elway because he's so competitive. But if you're real about where you are, right, and you look at the fact that you've gone 8-24 over your last 32 games, if you're being honest with yourself, it's time to tear the thing down. It's time to rebuild. It's time to start to invest in your young players. And it's time to build up assets. And so I'd understand not dealing Von Miller just because of everything he means to the franchise. And, you know, to people in that building personally, too. But I certainly think guys like Emmanuel Sanders and Chris Harris could be on the move. Did you mention one other guy, too, Shelby? I thought of four.
Not just them.
Just four. Okay. So I would say Sanders and Harris, yes. I would say with Von Miller, probably not. Shelby, question number five.
From Mort. Are there any top five QBs in the league without a top five O-line?
That's a great question, Mort. Well, right now, Brady doesn't have a top five line in front of him. That could change. We know how good Skarnecki is at developing guys. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to pull up the NFL. I'll pull up the stats now, and I'll look at the – we'll just give you – because this, I think, this is maybe the best objective way to do it. We can look at the top five guys in quarterback rating. And then we can give you guys a fair assessment of that. Okay. So Patrick Mahomes is number one. Absolutely has a very good offensive line in front of him with two excellent tackles in Eric Fisher and Mitchell Schwartz. Number two, Russell Wilson. A much better offensive line than he's had. Not top five. Kyle Allen, an improved offensive line with Matt Paradis there. Not top five. Dak Prescott's fourth. I would say, yes, that's a top five offensive line. So we've got two yeses, two noes. And then Lamar Jackson at number five. And the Ravens offensive line is a pretty good group. I like maybe borderline. You got Ronnie Stanley at left tackle. He's a sixth pick in the draft. You've got Marshall Yanda, who's an excellent player. You got Orlando Brown, promising young right tackle. So yeah, I mean, I think that I would say of those five guys, the top five guys, I would say three are playing with top shelf offensive lines, and two aren't. And it's a good point to make. It's a good point to make because you look at Brady now, and I brought up his name, and I think all of us would say he's still got it, right? I mean, 13th in quarterback rating, right behind Deshaun Watson. Jacoby Brissett's two in front of him on that list. Jacoby Brissett's got an excellent line. So, yeah, there's no question. Offensive line plays a big part of quarterbacking success. Shelby, question number six.
Hey, Albert. There was a story this past week on owners possibly going willing to look at a 17-game schedule. Do you think that's just a bargaining chip that they have no intention of playing? And secondly, do you think Thursday night games will ever go away out of the next CBA, or is there just a too big a revenue stream for the owners? Thanks.
All right, again, guys, leave your name. I want to address you guys by name, but I appreciate hearing your voice there, whoever you are, and I'll answer your question here. The 17-game schedule, to me, my suspicion has been 17 games, 18 games is a bargaining chip, and it's something that you can put on the table just to take off the table so you get some sort of return for it. And I would tell you that, and you know, we reported this a couple weeks ago in my MMQB column that really the stalemate that's exists now between the players and the owners, the players want a bigger piece of the revenue and no extra games. The owners want more games and the same revenue split. And so that's sort of where the divide is in the CBA talks. The owners, I think, are motivated to do something by the end of the year to get a deal done. Here's one thing I would mention that I think is sort of important to the 17-game argument. Yes, I think it's a bargaining chip. What's important, I think, is the importance the owners put on the International Series. And the International Series, to me, I know, you know, you'll see a game on Sunday in Tottenham, right? And this is a brand new stadium. Just do yourself a favor and watch 5 minutes of it. This thing looks like a football stadium. And the reason that it looks like a football stadium, even though it was built for Tottenham Hotspur, the soccer team, is because the league invested eight figures in it. The league made an eight-figure investment in this stadium. For the owners, this is a legacy thing. The owners want International to work. The owners want to be the first North American sports league to put a team permanently in Europe. The owners want this. This is very important to them. So it may not be important to you, but it's important to them. And they're the ones who are pushing all the buttons and pulling all the levers for the NFL. And so why do I bring that up here? Because one of the issues has been getting teams to give up home games. And now they're at the point where 31 of the 32 teams, the Packers are the only one who hasn't, have given up games and gone over there. Not everybody's given up a home game, but everybody's been over there, except the Packers. What 17 games would allow you to do, it would create more neutral site opportunities. And so my feeling is that if they do go to 17 games, a big part of it is going to be to prop up international games. And here's where I think it could work. Every team is committed to going over every other year. Or every team is committed to going over every 4 years, one of the two. If it's every other year, then what would that be? If it's every other year, then you would have 16. You would have 16 teams playing internationally each year, and that means eight neutral site games. If it's every other year, well, that'd be four games. So that's less than there is now. So it would be at least committing teams to going over every other year if they go to 17 games. Oh, and the second part of your question on Thursday night games, to me, I don't think the Thursday night games are going anywhere, because say what you will about the quality of them, they've been profitable for the NFL. And so if there's any changes coming, if the league were to put in a second bye week, I could see them trying to make it so teams got byes in front of the Thursday night games to improve the quality of the games. But they're not going to get rid of Thursday night games for the same reason that they're not getting rid of international. It all fits in one bucket. And that relates to the NFL's reaching of a breaking point in popularity. This is probably 10, 15 years ago, where it was almost impossible for them to grow any more than they had domestically. And so instead of growing up, they had to start to grow out. That meant adding inventory. That's what going back to LA was. That's what Thursday Night Football is. That's what expanding the playoffs is. That's what international is. And so the commissioner, Roger Goodell, was brought in to increase revenue. Like, that was what he did well in his previous job as the league's COO, creating new revenue streams, being creative, being inventive about that. And Thursday Night Football is a part of that. Thursday Night Football is going nowhere because the league has started to make it a very profitable endeavor. And last time I checked, those owners, they aren't giving a dollar back. All right, I appreciate you guys coming out. We're working through the new format. I hope it works. I want your feedback on it. So you can give us that on iTunes. I know it helps if you give us a rating and a review. So if you want to do that, you can do that right on our feed, the MMQB NFL podcast feed. Always appreciate getting feedback from you guys. You can also get to me. And again, you guys got good ideas. We'll incorporate some changes into the podcast. We're still working through this. You can get to me on my Twitter page at Albert Breer, my Facebook page at Albert R. Breer, my Instagram page at Albert_Breer. And listen to all the MMQB podcasts. We got a lot of good stuff on there now. We got the Monday morning podcast, which is a rotating cast of characters. We got this podcast on Tuesdays, which features the mailbag of my guests and all the other stuff we've gotten to over the course of the last 45 minutes or an hour. On Wednesdays, my old podcast partners, Connor and Jenny, they got their show. Thursdays, the Deep Dive podcast with Andy Benoit. Friday, Jonathan Jones has his Shoot Your Shot podcast. You can get all of these on one feed, the MMQB NFL podcast feed. And also, if you want bite-sized news, right? Like you want that news, you want it in a compact piece for your drive home every day. We got the 5-minute or so MMQB news podcast. You can subscribe to that too. Both those feeds are where you get all your shows. Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. You guys can get us there. And you guys can get me again next Tuesday. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.